18. If you're going to make macros and use the shell, Philip said, I suppose you'll need a computer you can do real work on, not that phone that has more computational memory than every computer at MIT the year I graduated, combined. Perhaps you should pop back to your time and get your computer.
I can't, Martin said. The last time I saw it, it was being dismantled by federal agents.
And it only took you a week to get into that much trouble? Philip asked.
All the trouble happened in the last 2 days. I spent the days leading up to that setting myself up for failure.
Preparation is the key to success. Or, in this case, the opposite, Philip said. I guess you'll have to get a new computer.
Drat. I do hate buying brand new computers, Martin said in a sarcastic monotone.
I know, right? It's just a burden you'll have to bear,
Philip responded in kind. Martin opened the settings dialog on the smartphone app. It felt like he had lived a lifetime since he created it. Back then, it had seemed like an unnecessary detail to allow himself the ability to change where and when the phone was broadcasting from on the fly. But now, he was glad he had gone to the trouble. He set the phone's time for a week before he fled his own time, applied the new settings, and opened the Amazon.com app. Walter and Margarita Banks stood in their living room, trying to understand what was happening. Their son Martin was acting very strangely. There were sirens blaring from their yard, and someone had just pounded rather insistently on the front door. They looked at the door, then looked at each other. Then looked at Martin when he stuck his head out of his bedroom door and said,
Hi, just checking, what's the capital of England?
Margarita answered.
London?
Martin slammed the door shut again. Whoever was pounding on the front door yelled,
We are federal agents! Open this door immediately!
Walter went to open the door, but only made it a step before Martin burst out of his bedroom again.
Don't open that door! Not yet!
Martin said. Walter froze.
Have any packages been delivered for me?
Yes, you got 2 boxes from Amazon yesterday. They're in the kitchen,
Margarita replied.
Awesome,
Martin said, almost singing as he ran to the kitchen. Then he stopped.
Wait, what, 2 boxes?
His mother pointed at the floor next to the back door, and there were 2 boxes from Amazon. Martin could tell from the shape of the boxes which one he had ordered. The second box was a mystery. The voice from beyond the front door shouted,
Open this door or we will break it down!
Martin knew that there was a limit to how much material he could reliably transport back in time, so the mystery box would just have to wait for another time, when he would probably know what it was anyway. He picked up his order and ran back to his room.
What kind of trouble are you in, son?
Walter asked.
No trouble, Dad. Everything's cool. Just don't open the door yet!
Martin said as casually as he could as he ran back into his room and slammed the door behind him. Martin rematerialized in the crystal ballroom of Philip's shop, hugging his Amazon.com box to his chest. Philip had explained that transporting anything too large was a risky proposition. Large objects are usually just a collection of small objects held together by glue, screws, or clips, which are themselves just smaller objects.
More than one wizard has filled a suitcase with stuff, teleported, and materialized holding nothing but a handle.
So keep it small,
Martin had said.
Yes, and just to be safe, try to hug it when you teleport. Surround the item as best you can with your limbs. Make more than one trip if you must.
So hug the box Martin had, and the box seemed to make the trip just fine. Martin's favorite part of buying a new computer was unboxing and setting up the system for the first time. This time it was even better because he was experiencing it through Philip's eyes, a man from 1984. The most advanced piece of hardware Philip had ever seen, aside from Martin's phone, was Gary's 1994 Apple PowerBook. When Martin unboxed the brand new 2012 laptop that looked like it was carved from a single billet of aluminum, Philip looked like his head was going to explode. Martin couldn't help smiling as Philip read the specifications on the side of the box, his lips moving slightly as if he were a linguist trying to read the Rosetta Stone. Philip shook his head.
I understand all of these specs, but the numbers are all so large. I don't know what any of it means. What on earth can a person do with 4 gigabytes of RAM?
Upgrade it immediately, Martin answered. Martin was delighted to see that the laptop had shipped with a partial charge on the battery, so Martin was able to boot it up and show Philip how modern operating systems worked, how high-definition movies looked, what 3D games were, and how fast the computer could perform tasks. Philip was visibly grateful and insanely jealous.
I could maybe get you one if you want, Martin offered.
Philip sighed.
No, I wouldn't know how to use it. I'd best stick with my Commodore. It fits my, you know, my computing style. Besides, I'll be able to get my own shiny new computer eventually, if I wait around long enough. That's the beauty of being immortal. You learn to appreciate delayed gratification.
Instead of learning the Shell's scripting language, they spent the rest of that day setting up and optimizing Martin's new computer. Thanks to the Shell, it was much easier to find the new laptop's entry in the file. All Philip had to do was point at it and say, Statisticoi, and the entry came up on the Commodore 64 screen.
Statisticoi. That means statistics, doesn't it?
Martin asked.
Yup.
Does Esperanto ever remind you of Pig Latin?
Yes. By the way, Esperanto for Pig Latin is Porco Latina.
They set the laptop's battery to constantly be full, like Martin's phone. For internet access, Martin simply used Wi-Fi to tether the laptop to his phone so he could access the phone's 4G connection, a process that thoroughly confounded Philip. Martin patiently talked Philip through it as they went. He enjoyed playing teacher to Philip's student instead of the other way around. The next morning, after a bowl of breakfast stew, they set up the laptop on the table in Philip's house and settled in to get access to the Shell. The Shell was hosted redundantly on many corporate and government servers, just like the file itself. Because they knew what to search for, they found what they were looking for pretty fast. They downloaded a version of the Shell interface that was designed for Windows XP. It was badly outdated from Martin's point of view, but it worked in emulation and was stable. The interface had large, cartoonish icons Martin could use to access the raw file, a sandbox for creating new powers and effects, a library of pre-existing powers and effects, and a graphical interface for combining them and assigning a trigger. Philip was explaining how to stack several effects to create the illusion of a single, unified effect when Martin felt a sudden chill.
Perfect timing, as always.
Philip groaned.
Huh, I've got goosebumps,
Martin said.
Yes, so have I. Sit back, kiddo. You're about to see a textbook example of how many different effects can be layered to make an impression on your audience. In this case, to give the impression that the wizard is trying far too hard to impress.
A breeze blew through the room, seeming to blow inward from all 4 of the walls, converging on a point in the middle of the room. The wind formed a small whirlwind, which grew and darkened as more dust, far more than had been in the room to begin with, was drawn into the vortex. All light in the room dimmed until it looked like midnight in the dead of winter, rather than a sunny fall morning. As the light died, a glow emanated from the whirlwind, which had formed into the size of a man. There was a deafening sound, like a gas truck exploding, but played in reverse. Then the room was filled with nothing but white light and silence. As Martin's eyes adjusted, he saw a marble statue of an impressive wizard where the whirlwind had been. The statue held its staff aloft with its muscular left arm. Its equally muscular right arm was flexing mightily with its hand at head height, gripping a tiny, brilliant white star as if it were a softball. The statue's square jaw was set, and its facial expression spoke of a serene confidence and a terrible purpose. The statue's flowing hair was blown back, as if it was standing directly in front of a fan. The light in the statue's hand pulsed orange, sending out a shockwave of fire that filled the room. Martin instinctively covered his face with his arms. Philip did not flinch. As the shockwave dissipated, the marble burned away to ash, which fell but seemed to disappear before it hit the floor. As the ash crumbled away, it left behind a real wizard in the same pose. The arms were thinner, the jaw was weaker, the hair was limper. It was, however, the same wizard. His robes were a deep emerald green with gold trim. His staff was black and as shiny as a piano. The figurehead was a small blue electric plasma ball, like teenage guys bought from mall novelty shops in the late 1980s. In an amplified voice with too much reverb, the wizard said,
"Be not afeard! I, Merlin, have appeared!"
Philip groaned, then said,
"Hello, Jimmy,"
without enthusiasm.
"Would it kill you to knock?"
Jimmy smiled.
"Hello, Philip. Lovely to see you. I apologize for not knocking, but as you know, I put a lot of effort into my entrance."
"Clearly."
"Yes, and the whole effect would be spoiled if it was preceded by me meekly knocking on the door and asking if anyone was home. It wouldn't be nearly as impressive now, would it?"
"Do I look impressed now?"
Philip asked.
"Why no, dear fellow, you never look impressed. That's part of your charm. What if, instead of knocking, you made three sonic booms in the cadence of a person knocking?"
Martin asked.
"Then he could wait for an answer."
Jimmy's eyes widened.
"That's a genuinely good idea. You must be this apprentice I've heard so much about. Pleased to meet you. You can call me Merlin."
Philip muttered,
"Or you can call him Jimmy, which is his name."
"Yes, thank you, Philip. I must say, Martin, I'd heard you were clever. Lots of people tell me their ideas, but I rarely hear one I like. I'm impressed."
"Yes,"
Philip added.
"Someday, when your ears are bleeding because you're being subjected to shave and a haircut played in sonic booms, you'll know you have yourself to thank."
Jimmy and Martin shook hands. Jimmy had a firm grip and a dry hand. He grasped Martin's right elbow with his left hand as they shook. He leaned in close to Martin's right ear, and quietly enough that Philip couldn't hear, but without whispering, asked,
"Is Philip treating you all right, Martin? Is he teaching you what you need to know? He's not making you do all of his housework or anything, is he, Martin?"
"No,"
Martin replied quietly.
"He's great. We're getting along fine."
"Good, Martin,"
Jimmy said, still shaking Martin's hand, leaning in close and almost whispering into his ear.
"If there are any problems, Martin, I want you to contact me. Will you do that, Martin?"
Before Martin could answer, both he and Jimmy were startled by Philip leaning in very close to Martin's other ear and grasping Martin's left shoulder.
"Martin,"
Philip said in hushed tones,
"is Jimmy acting creepy, Martin? Is he making lots of physical contact, Martin, and murmuring directly into your ear hole? Martin, is he saying your name, Martin, more often than any sane person would, Martin? Martin, it's almost as if he read a book on how to cruise chicks at a discotheque, and Martin realized he could apply those lessons to everyone he met, isn't it, Martin? Martin, Martin, Martin?"
If Martin had been farther from Jimmy's face, he'd have missed the look of irritation that quickly changed to a surprisingly genuine expression of amused good grace. Jimmy released Martin's arm and took a step back, laughing lightly and spreading his arms in a friendly, expansive gesture.
"Now, Philip, if you're not careful, you're going to give Martin the impression that we don't get along."
"We don't,"
Philip said, clenching his fists. Jimmy quite deliberately looked confused.
"Philip, I've always gotten along with you just fine."
"Yes, Jimmy, you get along with me, but I don't get along with you. Partly because you don't recognize that the word we refers to more than just you."
Jimmy laughed.
"Ah, Philip, you are a pistol.
I wish."
After a profoundly uncomfortable silence, Jimmy said,
"Well, I have other stops today. I'm out making the rounds, checking on projects."
He looked directly at Philip.
"The chairman's work is never done."
"We won't keep you,"
Philip replied.
"No, you won't,"
Jimmy said, initiating a second handshake with Martin.
"If I can be of any help, don't hesitate to ask. You'll be a fine addition to our community, Martin, I can tell."
Jimmy raised his staff above his head. Wind blew inward from the perimeter of the room again, converging on Jimmy, blowing his hair and making his robe flap like a flag. Jimmy spoke, but now his voice was louder, fuller, more epic.
And don't worry about the trials, Martin. If you do, you'll psych yourself out and fail, and that would be very bad.
The whirlwind converged and coalesced around Jimmy. There was a blinding light, a loud noise, and then silence. An idealized marble statue of Jimmy stood where the real thing had been. Then it crumbled into ashes that disintegrated before they hit the ground. When the dust cleared, all that was left was a scorch mark on the spot where Jimmy had stood. The scorch was in the shape of an M inside a pentagram. Philip rubbed at the mark with his boot. It wiped away easily.
It stands for moron, he said as he finished removing it.
He seems friendly, Martin said.
Yes, that's the problem with him. He seems friendly.
Martin knew that the wise move would be to leave it alone and get on with their day. He also knew that he wasn't going to do that.
It's obvious that you detest him.
Obvious to everyone but him.
Oh, I think he knows.
Philip turned to face Martin, his eyes full of hope.
Do you think so? Do you think he knows how I feel? Oh, I hope that's true. Maybe he even feels the same way about me.
I think he may. What's your deal? Are you mad because he's Merlin and you're not?
Philip sat down at the table and slumped over, as if tired from the exertion of hating Jimmy.
No, I hate him because he's not Merlin. There is no Merlin and there probably never was. Look, when I came to this time, I knew I'd be disguising myself as a wizard and hoped I'd be known as a good one. I thought that was a pretty good goal. Good enough for me, at least, but clearly not good enough for Jimmy. When Jimmy came back here, it was with the intention of making people recognize him as Merlin, whether they wanted to or not, and he proceeded to scramble countless people's lives so he could bend reality to his will.
You're angry because he changed the past.
Yes. You could boil it down to that.
But you're changing the past too.
Yes, but on a much smaller scale and for very different reasons. I made small changes in hopes of making a better life for myself and others. He made huge changes to create a much better life for himself and a slightly better life for everyone else, maybe, if they were lucky. But if not, he's not really bothered.
A long silence passed as Martin tried to understand, and Philip tried to find a more elegant explanation.
Shortly after I got here, I decided the repository, the file, as you call it, would be much more useful if it had a simplified interface. I started working on the shell. I told Jimmy about it. He helped a little. When new wizards would turn up, he'd show them our shell that we made. Later on, I'd meet new wizards who had met Jimmy first, and they'd ask me what it was like helping Jimmy invent the shell.
Ah, Martin said. You want more credit?
No, it's not about credit. It's about theft.
Theft of credit, Martin said.
Look,
Philip said.
The world can be described as a war between two sides. The problem is that everybody has a different idea of what those two sides are. Liberals versus conservatives, Star Wars fans versus Star Trek fans, people who see the world in terms of us versus them, and people who don't. There are thousands of different two kinds of people. The way I see it, civilization is a war between people like me and people like Jimmy.
Okay. Who are the people like you and who are the people like Jimmy?
Martin, did you ever play basketball?
Yes.
Tell me, what's a foul?
It's when a player breaks one of the rules. Do it 5 times and you're kicked out of the game. 6 if it's the NBA. Philip smiled.
Good. The best way I've ever summed up the war as I see it is that one side, our side, sees a foul as being against the rules. And if you do it too many times, you have to be removed. The other side, Jimmy's side, sees fouls as things you're allowed to get caught doing several times. And if you don't, you aren't trying hard enough.
So you're mad at Jimmy because you think his side cheats at life?
Partly. Mostly I'm mad because I'm pretty sure his side is going to win.
They spent the rest of that day covering the creation of macros, and they got a lot of training accomplished. But Philip's mood never really recovered. It wasn't until the next day, after a good night's sleep, that his smile seemed genuine again. In fact, as Philip roused Martin from the hammock, Philip's smile seemed a little too genuine.
"Get up, me lad! I've got something special planned for you today!"
Martin rubbed the sleep from his eyes as he carefully dismounted the hammock.
"What is it? I was hoping to work some more on macros. I have a few ideas."
Philip shrugged theatrically.
"Well, we could spend the day at the computer, if you'd rather, and just leave learning to fly for another day."
"No, no," Martin said, quickly grabbing his staff. "If you think it's time to try flying," he continued, struggling to pull on his robe. "Then I, as the, student," he stammered, realizing that pulling on the robe would be easier if he weren't holding his staff,
"should defer to your expertise," he said, setting down the staff and successfully donning his robe. "And learn to fly today."
Martin had gone from sleep to standing, ready to leave in 10 seconds and one run-on sentence.
"Now, now, don't be so hasty. You haven't had any breakfast," Philip said. "Here, have one of these. It should tide you over until lunch."
He handed Martin a palm-sized rectangle of something wrapped in cloth.
"What is it?" Martin asked.
"It's something I'm experimenting with. Are you familiar with the idea of a breakfast bar?"
Martin unwrapped it eagerly.
"Yeah, in my time we tend to call them energy bars. I didn't know you had chocolate."
"I don't. This is much healthier. It's a block of dried stew."
It did tide Martin over until lunch, in that it made him lose all interest in eating. He and Philip went outside. Philip held out his hand, and Martin willingly put his hand in Philip's. Martin just happened to look down the street and happened to see Kluge staring at him from a distance, but not so great a distance that he couldn't see Kluge smile at noticing that Martin had noticed him. Philip held his staff aloft in his free hand and pointed its top, with a decorative glass bottle of Tabasco sauce, toward the sky. Philip looked upward, said,
"Floogie!"
And they were soaring into the sky. They flew about 15 miles. In modern times, that is not far. But in the Middle Ages, it was a huge distance. They flew over the forest until they came to a large clearing full of tall grass. In the middle of the clearing, two men in wizard robes were waiting for them. As Philip swooped in for a landing, Martin could see that it was Gary and Jeff.
"Guys, good to see you! I didn't know you were going to be here,"
Martin said.
"We wouldn't have missed it,"
Gary said.
"We wizards always come out for an apprentice's first flight."
"Where's Tyler?"
Philip asked.
"Don't know,"
Jeff answered.
"He went out yesterday for some book research and hasn't come back. Some farmer's probably telling him a story about yams that he thinks he can make into a tale of high adventure. He loses track of time."
"He's gonna be bummed that he missed your first flight,"
Gary said.
"It's a tradition."
"Yeah," Jeff said. "It's like when they launch a ship by breaking a bottle on its prow."
"But instead of a ship, it's you."
"And instead of a bottle, it's the ground."
"And there's no breaking involved. Just bouncing."
"Bouncing?" Martin asked. "I'm gonna bounce?" Philip shook his head.
"Only if you crash."
"Which means yes,"
Gary added helpfully.
"Don't worry, though,"
Philip said, scowling at Gary.
"Thanks to the various protective spells I applied to you, you can't be injured."
"Oh,"
Martin said, visibly relieved.
"Good. As long as I can't get hurt."
"No, you'll get hurt," Jeff said. "Just not injured. Your skin won't cut and your bones won't break, but you'll still feel pain if you run a knife across your skin, or you get poked hard with something sharp."
"Or if you fall screaming out of the sky at terminal velocity and land on the hard, rocky ground,"
Gary said, stomping on the ground to emphasize its hardness. Philip put his hand on Martin's shoulder.
Don't listen to them, Martin. They're just trying to scare you. Oh, they're not lying. You will probably fall and bounce, and it will smart like mad, but they're just telling you about it to scare you. Now, let's get you up in the air, shall we?
Moments later, Martin was standing alone. The other three wizards were watching him intently, but giving him plenty of room.
All right, Philip said. We fly using our staff.
Rule one, Martin said reflexively. Don't make the obvious joke.
Indeed, Philip said. Have you ever ridden a motorcycle?
Yes.
How'd that go?
I crashed.
This is gonna be great, Jeff said.
Gary giggled.
Ignore them, Philip said. That doesn't just mean today. In general, it's best to ignore them. Anyway, flying is a lot like riding a motorcycle in two ways. It's more about leaning than steering. And if you look at something, you're going to steer into it even if you don't want to. Now, put your hand about halfway down your staff and hold it over your head.
Martin did. Philip said,
good. Now, think of the staff as your controls. Point the head of your staff forward and you go faster. Pull it back, you slow down. Tilt it to the left and you'll bank left. Tilt right, bank right. Tilt your wrist up and you'll angle upward. Tilt your wrist down and you'll angle down. It sounds like a lot to remember, but if you think of it like you're letting your staff lead you, it's very intuitive.
Martin said, kind of like riding a Segway. Philip and Gary said,
what?
At the same moment, Jeff said,
yes.
Martin asked, how fast can we fly?
There's no theoretical limit, but the shell keeps us down to 100 miles an hour, which, believe me, is more than fast enough when you're up there in the wind with nothing but a robe and hat for protection.
Martin took a deep breath, then raised the staff over his head. He held it there for a moment, then lowered it again.
Do I have to say floogie?
He asked.
It's the least dignified magic word ever.
Right now, yes. Later you can make a macro and set any word you like. Make sparkles trail behind you, whatever. During training, we're focusing on basic flight, and to do that, you say floogie.
Martin raised the staff above his head again. He shook the tension out of his left hand, which was hanging by his side, paused a second to work up his nerve, and said,
floogie.
Nothing happened. He was still standing firmly on the ground. He looked at Philip, fearing that he was yet again being messed with. Philip smiled and said,
point the staff upward a bit.
Just a bit!
You want to start slow.
Martin tilted the head of the staff upward, and he smoothly raised about 30 feet before he panicked and tilted the staff back, stopping all upward progress. He hovered there, oscillating between laughing, shouting, and being too stunned to make a sound. He had known intellectually that he was going to fly at some point, but now he knew that he was flying, and that was a different matter. He was sure it looked like he was hanging by one hand from his staff, but that was not how it felt. It didn't feel like he was weightless either. It felt as if every atom in his body had simply decided it was time to move in the same direction, and that direction just happened to be straight up. He looked down at Philip, Jeff, and Gary. They looked delighted as they cheered Martin on. Philip raised his staff, said,
floogie,
and drifted up to meet Martin. Jeff produced his magic wand, pointed it at the sky, and shot upward with an eerie humming sound and distorted shockwave emanating from the spot where he had stood. Gary whipped his staff around in an arc, chanting,
Mi estas, misera, spectaculo extera.
He held his staff aloft and rose slowly but forcefully on a pillar of black smoke, so thick you could not see through it. Soon all four of them were hovering there, 30 feet in the air.
Okay, Philip said. You've got hovering down. Now it's time to fly. Remember, just sort of point your staff where you want to go. It's that simple.
Martin pointed the staff a degree or two upward, then tilted his wrist downward, and he gracefully leveled off. His staff led, and his body trailed behind. What had been pointing his staff upward now felt like it was leading him forward. He turned his head to look behind and saw the others following him. He experimented with some turns. He tried gaining and losing altitude. He swooped. He spiraled. He went as fast as he comfortably could, which wasn't all that fast with the wind in his eyes. He shielded his face with his free hand and tried for a high-speed swoop. He swung down within a few feet of the ground, then gave it the spurs as he angled back toward the sky. He was 50 feet in the air and accelerating upward at a steep angle. Between the speed he was moving, the hand shielding his eyes, and the squinting in the wind, he nearly didn't see the duck. Later, Philip told him he probably would have missed the duck entirely if he hadn't reacted, but he had, involuntarily cringing and pulling his staff arm in to shield his face. In doing so, he dropped the staff's airspeed to nearly zero, then to full reverse, banked a hard right turn, and stuck the staff into a steep dive all at the same time. Martin's body cracked like a whip, flinging him out in front of the staff as he lost his grip. Without his hand to hold it, the staff lost all power and tumbled to the ground. Martin's momentum flung him rear-end first directly into the now very startled duck. He and the duck fell earthward. For a crazy moment, it seemed to Martin that he was sitting on the duck, which was horribly undignified for both of them. The duck seemed to agree as it rolled between his legs and up the front of his torso, flapping wildly and quacking like mad the whole way. It bounced off of his face, and for just an instant, Martin was aware of a duck foot in his mouth. Then the duck disappeared from his perception. Martin didn't know where it went and didn't care. He was more concerned with the ground, which was coming up to meet him quite eagerly. As he tumbled, Philip, Gary, and Jeff spun into his field of view, closing on his position very fast. Gary and Jeff seemed to be yelling something. Philip was hurling his staff around like a lacrosse stick and shouting something as well. A blue ball of energy shot from the head of Philip's staff and flew like a line drive, hitting the ground directly in front of Martin. He had just enough time to feel gratitude for Philip for helping him when he needed it. Martin hit the ground full force. The pain was instant and blinding. He bounced into the air and had just enough time to curse Philip before he hit the ground again, this time rolling to a stop. He lay on the ground, groaning. Jeff and Gary landed. Martin raised himself up from the ground and looked around. The spot where he had initially hit the ground was marked with a glowing blue circle. Radiating out from that circle were ever larger concentric blue rings spaced a foot apart. Gary was counting the rings.
12,
Gary said, shaking his head sadly.
That's 4 yards. Jeff, you guessed 13. You were over. I had 9 and Philip had 10, so Philip wins.
The duck slowed him down, Jeff noted bitterly. Guess that means we both owe you a buck.
No, Philip said. To be honest, I lost our other bet this morning. Martin didn't eat the stew bar.